Welcome to New Letters on the Air. I'm Rebecca Presson. Our guest today is a writer who's widely acknowledged as a master of the short story, Grace Paley. Grace Paley began publishing short stories in the late 1950s, but her tremendous reputation is based on just three books. Paley's books of stories, The Little Disturbances of Man, Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, and Later the Same Day, are all still in print and all widely read. All contain evidence of what was once written in Commonweal magazine, how poetic an entity a good short story is. Perhaps that's because Paley is a poet, and her new and collected poems have recently been published. We'll hear from that book today. Paley says there's a rule governing both her fiction and her poetry, and that is that both can be taken literally.
I tell it in the truest way that I can, and what I think of as the clearest way. I don't believe in being obscure, or I don't want to be. I can imagine sometimes being difficult or you know, complex and not understanding right off what I mean, maybe reading it twice. But my intentions are clarity. I don't believe in obscurity on purpose or opacity.
Are you mainly, do you think, just trying to tell a story and everything else just happens to be there because it's in you? Or do you think about...
Well, I'm trying to tell a story, which may be a complicated story. I think in a poem I have here, which maybe I'll read, called The Storytelling, for me, there are many different ways of telling stories. Maybe I should read that poem.
Please
now.
Do, okay. Yeah.
This is a poem about storytelling. When I say the artist, I mean the writer or the artist, any artist, poet, writer. The artist comes next. She tells the story of the stories. The first person may be the child who says, "Listen, guess what happened?" The important listener is the mother. The mother says, "What?" The first person can be the neighbor. She says, "Today my son told me, goodbye." I said, "Really? Who are you? You didn't even say hello yet." The listener is probably her friend. She remembers, "Well, wasn't he always like that as a small boy? I mean," the neighbor says, "that's not true. You're absolutely wrong. He was like a motorcycle, a little horse, every now and then at rest, a flower." The first person is often the lover who says, "I never knew anyone like you." The listener is the beloved. She whispers, "Who, me?" The first person is the giver of testimony. He rises and tells, "I lived in that village. My father shouted. He returned from the fields. I was too small. My father cried out, 'Why don't you grow up and help me?' My mother said, 'Help him. You're 8 years old. It's time.' The listeners say, 'Oh, it was just like that in my village, I remember.' The giver of testimony rises and tells, 'I lived in the hut behind the barn. The padron, the manager, the master came to me. 'I can take you whenever I want,' he said. 'Now you're old enough. The right age is 12, he said. The giver of testimony rises. She looks into her village. She looks into the next village. Where are the listeners? The artist comes next. She waits for the listeners, too. What if they're all dead or deafened by grief or in prison? Then there's no way out of it. She will listen. It's her work. She will be the listener in the story of the stories." What I mean to say is in that, when I say the artist tells the story of the stories, it becomes more complex than the child saying, "You know what happened?" You know? It's as though there are always two or three stories that the artist makes a story of.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah. So.
Yeah. And another thing I liked in that poem that you do in a lot of your poems that seems different from your fiction is that you tend to use a lot of sentence fragments in poems,
mm-hmm.
things that allude to a sentence, but mm-hmm. it's kind of like, well, you get the idea, you don't need the rest of the
mm-hmm.
sentence.
Yeah. Do I? It's okay.
Yeah. Is that what you're saying?
No, it's not. It's just that I'm always so conscious of what I'm doing. So I mean, I do that. Yes, okay, I do.
But I mean, do you stop because you figure, well, we don't need the rest of
right.
this?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, the idea of a poem is always, to a certain degree, compression. I mean, not all poets or all poems are like that, but mostly it's tension making. A woman invented fire and called it the wheel. Was it because the sun is round? I saw the round sun bleeding to sky, and fire rolls across the field from forest to treetop. It leaps like a bike with a wild boy riding it. Oh, she said, see the orange wheel of heat, light that took me from the window of my mother's home to home in the evening.
That was Grace Paley reading the first poem in her book of new and collected poems on New Letters on the Air. You just said a second ago that it's not as simple as that, but do you think maybe in a sense it is as simple as that, that there are these sort of stories that we all have in our life and that all storytelling is just a remaking of those stories?
Well, I think that everybody tells stories, so that's why people like stories, because they tell them all the time. You tell a story every day. I mean, you may, depending on who you are, you may tell one story, you may tell 15 stories during the day to different people. You know what happened? You know, just like that. So that's one thing that happens all the time. But then the artist comes next and listens really to the stories that you tell. And tries to understand them, and tries to understand where they come from, and tries to tell them again in a way which illuminates more of life.
Now, you're not necessarily saying that stories should be redemptive or parabolic. You're just saying they should have more insight?
Well, first of all, they should be interesting. Second of all, they should have tension in them in order to be interesting. They have to have it. They have to have in them the need that the storyteller, the writer, has to tell the story. I mean, you should feel that the storyteller is really saying, I want to tell you something. You know, not, oh, this happened today, but I want to tell you something. See, that should be in the story for it to be interesting, you know, not for any esoteric reason, but because you need that tension for it to be interesting.
And a lot of times, I know, like in the story Friends, you could, on the one level, that's just kind of rambling conversation, but on the other, there is one person who's dying, and so there's an urgency given to that story just by that circumstance.
Well, I had great urgency to tell that story, which is called Friends. It was on my mind for a long, long time, I even had the first sentence for it for quite a while, and then I wrote the first page or two, and I couldn't figure out what to do with it next, you know. But the pressure to tell my friend's story was very strong.
What was the first sentence?
It was something like this: to put us at our ease, to quiet our hearts as she lay dying, our dear friend Selena said, life, after all, has not been an unrelieved horror. You know, I did have many wonderful years with her.
Oh, of course. I almost wrote that down. Life has not been an unrelieved horror.
Yeah. You know, I did have many wonderful years with her. She did say that sentence, you know, and I never forgot it. But it was years after her death that I wrote that. Old age and the conventions of retirement have driven my friends from the work they love. These are stanzas, and each stanza really represents a person. One. When she was young, she wanted to sing in a bank, a song about money. The lyrics of gold was her song. She dressed for it. Two. She did good. She stood up like a planted flower among yellow weeds, turning to please the sun. They were all shiny. It was known she was planted. Three. No metaphor reinvents the job of the nurture of children except to muddy or muck. 4. The job of hunting, of shooting in hunting season, of standing alone in the woods, of being an Indian. 5. The municipal center, the morning of anger, the centrifugal dream, her voice flung out on plates of rage. Then they were put in a paper sack. She was sent to the china closet and never came back. 6. Every day he went out, forsaking wife and child. With his black bag, he accompanied the needle of pain as it sewed our lives to death. 7. One day at work, he cried, "I am in my full powers." Suddenly, he was blind. When slabs of time and aperture returned, "Dear friend," we asked, "what do you see?" He said, "I only see what has been seen already." This is another poem about being older. Question: do you think old people should be put away? The one red, rheumy eye, the pupil that goes back and back, the hands are scaly. Do you think all that should be hidden? Do you think young people should be seen so much on Saturday night, hunting and singing in packs the way they do, standing on street corners looking this way and that? Or the small children who are visible all the time, everywhere, and have nothing to do but be smart, but be athletes, but jump, but climb high fences? Do you think hearts should sink? Do you think the arteries ought to crumble when they could do good? Because the heart was made to endure. Why does it not endure? Do you think this is the way it should be? I moved to the country after living in the city for about 65 years. And I thought I might read you a couple of those poems that I wrote. I call them Thetford poems because that's where I'm living now. I'm living in Thetford, Vermont. This one is called Fear. I am afraid of nature. Because of nature, I am mortal. My children and my grandchildren are also mortal. I lived in the city for 40 years. In this way, I escaped fear. What would happen if there were a terrific shortage of goldenrod in the world, and I put my foot outside this house to walk in my garden and show city visitors my two lovely rose bushes and three remarkable goldenrod plants that were doing well this year? I would say, look how on each of several sprigs there are 2-3 dozen tiny stems, and on each stem 3-4 tiny golden flowers, petals, stamen, pistil, and the pollen which bees love, but insufficiently. Otherwise, can you imagine the fields on rainy days in August, brass streaking the lodged hay heads, dull brass in the rain, and under the hot sun, the golden flowers floating, gold dust of August fields for miles and miles.
This is New Letters on the Air, and our guest is Grace Paley, who's reading from her new and collected poems. The poems about the ocean and drowning and so on at the beginning of the book, are those older poems?
Well, they vary. I mean...
They don't seem to be. By book or by date or anything.
They're not by date at all. In fact, old age and the conventions of retirement, the first two poems are rather later poems.
Okay,
I just sort of put them in where they seem right.
I wondered, because, you know, one thinks of you as such an urban writer, and now suddenly we get a little bit of nature here and there. You mentioned you wanted to read some poems about aging. When this program airs, you'll be 71.
Yeah.
And is just a natural concern that comes with getting a little older? Or?
Yeah, I think so. Well, the ones on retirement and the sort of joke of it, if there's a joke involved at all, is that the last one, question, do you think old people should be put away? I actually must have written that 12 years ago. I mean, I didn't write it that recently. I wasn't even thinking of myself. I was really thinking then of old people I knew, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I wasn't even up to myself, so to speak, you know.
I have the impression that you are aware that you are a mentor to many younger women and that you accept and even enjoy that position. Is that true?
Well, I don't think of myself that way, you know. I've been teaching for a long time, so I do know, you know, so I've been knowing younger women, many of whom have gotten a lot older by now, you know, 25 years. They're some of them are close to 50, I guess. So, I mean, I know them, and I've worked with them. I think I learn as much from them. I mean, I say this really not to be cutesy or anything like that, but I've always paid attention to what young people are thinking about or the direction they're going, because they're what comes next.
Well, I mean, there are a lot of people who think you're one of the very best living American writers, and yet there's not a trace of prima donnaism about you any time that I've ever seen you. You seem like really down to earth. Are you sort of removed from the knowledge of that, or what? I mean,
well, no, I feel I've been very fortunate in the response to the books that I've written, but I've been lucky in a sense of not having them like become runaway bestsellers, or you know, it's like I've had the fortune of having them continue so that they're still in print and people still read them and come up to me and say, oh, I just read your first book. And I'm astonished to think that people still like that book. I mean, it's, and I don't mean it in some kind of a, oh, you like my book, you know, anything like that. But I mean, I'm pleased and I'm happy that that's true. But I do have a very strong sense of the relation of the writer to the history of the time, and I feel that I've been fortunately placed in that, being a woman at a time when women's literature began to be read, beginning to write short stories, just before the short story began to be published again. I mean, so I've somehow had the luck of being in the right time zone somehow, or something like that. Or
were you just doing what you wanted to do, and that happened? I mean, your first book was published in the '50s.
It was in 59, and I was very frightened for it because I felt it was had a lot of stuff about women in it. I was, you know, mostly about women, and mostly about women and children. A lot of children suddenly appeared in literature, you know. And I thought, oh, no one will ever be interested in any of this stuff, you know. But it turned out that some people were, you know.
When you first started publishing, was there still this sort of mindset that said that there was this competition among women, like women really only were taken seriously if they made friends with men instead of other women, or that you always kind of looked down the nose at the wife, and because you women who wrote and published books were in a different class?
I personally was very untouched by all that, because for many years after I began writing, I really I tried not to know writers. But then I suddenly began to know them all.
You know, Diana Trilling talks about this in her new autobiography about how she was so snubbed because she was a wife.
Because she was a wife, right. Yeah. Well, I mean, I've always been in the situation where I feel, as a feminist, I've always felt absolutely on line with everybody's wife. I mean, the guys I knew. I mean that, you know. I absolutely have felt, you know, are you gonna let them deal with you like that? I mean, you know, really, I'm a total.
You're sort of a born feminist.
I'm a born union maid, so to speak. I mean, I believe in the trade union of women, wives, and mothers. It's a working union, and I'm in it. Life. Some people set themselves tasks. Other people say, "Do anything, only live." Still others say, "Uh-oh, I will never forget you." Event of my first life.
The minute I read that, I thought, well, this is obvious. Grace sets tasks. She's someone who wants to accomplish things with her life. She doesn't want to just live it. Is that right? Is that true?
No.
No.
I think I'm more in the second line.
I thought about that because I thought of you telling people, if you want to do things with your life, don't smoke because of your friend.
Oh, yeah, right. Well, it's just getting older. I get bossier and snottier and tell people, don't smoke, don't do this, do that, you know. Get home. Get
now that your children are grown.
Get some sleep. Take vitamin C. You know.
Speaking of children being grown, would you read the story about your son teaching school?
My son
teaching
Danny.
Kids to read. Yeah. That's a delightful poem. It's sort of magical.
I like that poem. This is for my son Danny, who teaches in a school in the lowest east side, I should say, of New York. For Danny. My son enters the classroom. There are 32 children waiting for him. He dreams that he will teach them to read. His head is full of the letters that words are looking for. Because of his nature, his fingers are flowers. Here is a rose, he says. Look, it grew right into the letter R. They like that idea very much. They lean forward. So he says, now spell garden. They write it correctly in their notebooks, maybe because the word rose is in it. My son is happy. Now spell sky. For this simple word, the children turn their eyes down and away. Doesn't he know the city has been quarreling with the sky all of their lives? Well, he says, spell home. He's a little frightened to ask this of them. What? They laugh. They can't hear him say, what's so funny? They jump up out of their seats laughing. My son says hopefully, it's 3 o'clock, but they don't want to leave. Where will they go? They want to stay right here in the classroom. They probably want to spell garden again. They want to examine his hand. For some reason, I wrote actually two poems about drowning. I guess I'll read both of them.
Yeah.
And I don't know why, but drowning. One, if I were in the middle of the Atlantic, drowning, far from home, I would look up at the sky, veil of my hiding life, and say, goodbye. Then I would sink. The second time I'd come up, I'd say, these are the willful waves of the watery sea which is drowning me. Then I would sink. The third time I'd come up, it would be my last. My arms reaching, my knees falling, I'd cry. Oh, oh, first friend of my thinking head, dear flesh, farewell. Drowning, 2. This is how come I am drowned. First the sun shone on me, then the wind blew over me, then the sand polished me, then the sea touched me, then the tide came. That's kind of scary now that I've read it.
It is. It's lovely, though.
Yeah.
There's a, seems to me, a continuing theme throughout your writing, or a question, an examination of what it makes up a successful life, and what will make a person happy. And it doesn't seem like there is any definite answer, but maybe just to have more good times than bad. I don't know.
No, I think it's really, I have a story in my first book called An Interest in Life.
Mm-hmm.
And I really stick by that. I think it's to be interested always. And you find old people, you'll meet people who've really lost interest, and that expression is used even. Someone will say to you, I don't know what to do with my father. I mean, he's just lost interest, you know? And so that for me, the only way to live is to be interested in life. And that means not only in yourself, it means in the world around you and in the people around you. And then how things are going, and you know? And a friend of mine just died at 92, and she was not only interested till the end, she was furious till the end, you know. She just was very, very angry.
Are you writing more poems now, or stories, or
Both. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have to write them. I have to write them both. I mean, it's hard for me to write stories if I'm not writing poems too. I don't mean I write them in equal amounts. You know, I mean, write a poem story, but anything like that. But I have to have the space that a poem requires for me to be able to also be writing stories.
Is one bigger or smaller than the other, or just different?
You mean the spaces? Mm-hmm. No. I need that beginning space that mm-hmm. you know that a kind of an indolence, a kind of a you know laziness of the spirit, so to speak. You know.
No, I don't know. Yeah. Tell me.
Well, I mean, an ability to hang out in your mind, so you know, which is a little not much different from hanging out on a street corner. But in a sense, imagine that you're just hanging out in your mind and thinking and able to do that.
Did you want to read one more poem, or do you want to go home?
Yeah, I'll read this last poem in the book, which I like to read as the last poem. It's called In the Bus. Somewhere between Greenfield and Holyoke, snow became rain, and the child passed through me. As a person moves through mist, as the moon moves through a dense cloud at night, as though I were cloud or mist, a child passed through me. On the highway that lies across miles of stubble and tobacco barns, our bus speeding, disordered the slanty rain, and a girl with no name, naked, wearing the last nakedness of childhood, breathed in me once, no, two breaths, a sigh. She whispered, "Hey, you, begin again. Again? Again, again. You'll see. It's easy. Begin again. Long ago."
Grace Paley was recorded at KCUR-FM in Kansas City. She read from her volume of new and collected poems published by Tilbury House in St. Paul, Minnesota. Paley's books of short stories are The Little Disturbances of Man, Enormous Changes at the Last Minute, and Later the Same Day. Copies of this and a 1991 program featuring Grace Paley on New Letters on the Air are available on cassette. If you'd like a copy of our 48-page catalog, write to us with your name and address and the call letters of the station you hear us on. Our address is New Letters on the Air, University of Missouri, Kansas City, Missouri, 64110. Our phone number is area code 816-235-1159. New Letters on the Air is a production of New Letters, the literary magazine published at the University of Missouri, Kansas City, and edited by James McKinley. Our studio engineer for this program was John Hawken. Assistant producer is Margaret Smith. The Missouri Arts Council provides financial support. I'm Rebecca Presson. On the next New Letters on the Air, Grace Paley says that when she began writing short stories in the 1950s, her timing was right.
But I do have a very strong sense of the relation of the writer to the history of the time, and I feel that I've been fortunately placed in that, being a woman at a time when women's literature began to be read.
Listen for Grace Paley on New Letters on the Air.